Welcome to National Liberty Alliance's weekly conference call. Today is Monday, September 5th, 2022. We broadcast live every Monday from 9 p.m. to 11 p.m. Eastern. If you're listening live over our radio or another network and you would like to ask a question or make a comment, you can go to nationallibertyalliance.org and click on our weekly call for instructions to join us by phone, app, or browser. If anyone would like to email a question, you can send your questions to questions, that's plural, questions at nationallibertyalliance.org. Also, please support our business partners. You can find their banners on the right-hand side of a website of which the proceeds go to support NLA's effort to save our republic. Also, please support NLA by donating $5 a month or more, or click on our donation tab on the top right-hand side of our website. Also, you can join our campaign for constitutional sheriffs. You can find that information on the right-hand side of a website or on the front page also. Okay, tonight's scripture reading is we're in the book of Romans. And let me see if I can get to that. Okay. Yeah, we're in the book of Romans. We're in chapter 3. Last week we read chapter 2. So this week we'll be reading chapter 3 by Alexander Scorby.
Chapter 3. What advantage then hath the Jew, or what profit is there of circumcision? Much every way. Chiefly because that unto them were committed the oracles of God. For what if some did not believe? Shall their unbelief make the faith of God without effect? God forbid. Yea, let God be true, but every man a liar. As it is written, that thou mightest be justified in thy sayings, and mightest overcome when thou art judged. But if our unrighteousness commend the righteousness of God, what shall we say? Is God unrighteous who taketh vengeance? I speak as a man. God forbid. For then how shall God judge the world? For if the truth of God hath more abounded through my lie unto his glory, why yet am I also judged as a sinner, and not rather, as we be slanderously reported, and as some affirm that we say, let us do evil that good may come, whose damnation is just? What then? Are we better than they? No, in no wise. For we have before proved both Jews and Gentiles that they are all under sin. As it is written, there is none righteous, no, not one. There is none that understandeth. There is none that seeketh after God. They are all gone out of the way. They are together become unprofitable. There is none that doeth good. No, not one. Their throat is an open sepulcher. With their tongues they have used deceit. The poison of asps is under their lips, whose mouth is full of cursing and bitterness. Their feet are swift to shed blood. Destruction and misery are in their ways. And the way of peace have they not known. There is no fear of God before their eyes. Now we know that what things soever the law saith, it saith to them who are under the law, that every mouth may be stopped, and all the world may become guilty before God. Therefore, by the deeds of the law, there shall no flesh be justified in his sight, for by the law is the knowledge of sin. But now the righteousness of God without the law is manifested, being witnessed by the law and the prophets, even the righteousness of God, which is by faith of Jesus Christ, unto all and upon all them that believe. For there is no difference, for all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, being justified freely by his grace through the redemption that is in Christ Jesus, whom God hath set forth to be a propitiation through faith in his blood, to declare his righteousness for the remission of sins that are past through the forbearance of God. To declare, I say, at this time, his righteousness, that he might be just, and the justifier of him which believeth in Jesus. Where is boasting, then? It is excluded. By what law? Of works? Nay, but by the law of faith. Therefore, we conclude that a man is justified by faith without the deeds of the law. Is he the God of the Jews only? Is he not also of the Gentiles? Yes, of the Gentiles also, seeing it is one God which shall justify the circumcision by faith and uncircumcision through faith. Do we then make void the law through faith? God forbid. Yea, we establish the law.
Okay, Jan, do we have any questions or any announcements tonight?
Oh, we have a big bunch of questions, John.
Okay.
Okay, first question. Can you offer any advice on trying to get the tax assessor to remove my private property from the tax rolls? Would this be an appropriate place to use affidavits?
Well, yeah, I think I can. First of all, you're going to want to turn it into a private property. I would go trying to do that first. They may give you a hard time with that. I don't know that there's any particular procedure other than to say I want my property, written up on the books as a private property. That takes you out of the system because they're only dealing with the taxes on residential and commercial. So that's one possible way. Also, what we're going to be talking about tonight might be of assistance. Let me get to a page that we can get a little information. If you come under Education Starts Here, come down to the Law, and then come over and click on Court Forms and Process. We posted a book up here, Land Patent. It's a PDF book. I think it's 180 pages. It gives you a lot of information. I have not read through it. I know Gerard's supposed to be looking through this, and maybe he'll comment on it when he does look through it. I haven't had time to read through it. But it does look, I skimmed through it. It looks very interesting. It's given a lot of different information about the process and what's taking place and how it works and whatever else. Again, I haven't read through it. But there is a section in the book on how to turn your property over into what's called, what's the name of that? What's the word I'm looking for? I can't think of it. The alloidial titles. So there is a process to go through with that. So I would suggest first trying to reason with the individual to turn your property over to private property. And then secondly, read through this book very carefully and follow the process and then file the necessary papers accordingly and write a paper, And anytime you communicate with these people, you can go down physically and communicate and communicate verbally with them. That'd be fine. But it should all be in writing. And it should be, you can hand it to them and let them know that you're also dropping a certified copy into the mail. Where you'll have done by certified mail so you can show that you've served it upon the individual. And in the next step, if they continue to refuse to, obey your desire here with your property, the next step is the turn for oaths and bonds. And that's what we're going to talk a little bit about tonight. So when we get to that point tonight and talk about oaths and bonds, that's more information concerning the answer to the question here. Okay, next question. You're muted if you're talking. Jan? There you go. You're unmuted now. You there, Gerard? Oh, not Gerard, Jan, I mean. You're unmuted now. If you talk, I should hear you. I'm hearing scratching. I don't know, maybe your mic's half in or half out or something. I don't know. Yeah, we're not getting you. Hey, Terry, do you know if you have the questions also? Because we're not getting anything from Jan at the moment. Or maybe it's me that's not coming through. Am I coming through?
No, you're coming through. I hear you, John. I did not prepare them, but I can get probably the next one. But
meanwhile, Jan may be working on his sound, but go ahead.
Yeah.
His mic is open, but and I heard some scratching, like That was it. But if you got something, go ahead, and then maybe Jan will pick up. If not,
well, Ross, okay, hold on. I got to put in a password. Ross put in a question. He said, should National Liberty Alliance, and I don't know if I've got the right sequence or not, but should National Liberty Alliance partner with Mark Emery organization called Lighthouse Law Club? I will send NLA a link to the website. And he did. And the website is lighthouseliberty.club. So what do you think? Have you seen that?
Dot club, did you say? C-L-U-B?
Yes. Lighthouseliberty.club. Go ahead, Jan.
That's me. So, yeah, on that, I can't really comment because I don't know the individual. We're interested in partnershiping with anyone as long as we're compatible in our dealing with the government. You know, we don't have to agree on everything, of course, but as far as our process, we don't get involved in the fraud at all. We don't do the man on the land stuff. There's a lot of things we don't do. We just go in, use the common law, use the Constitution, use our founding fathers, quotes, and we call a fraud, and we go after that fraud, which is what we will be doing very, very shortly, really hardcore very soon. But that's about all I guess I could say at this point on that. So, now, if anybody wants to make contact with any group, to see if we can't get a connection where we can have a meeting and come together in a private room. And it would be open to anybody that wants to join us, of course, but the purpose of the meeting would be to discuss what we're doing with other groups and make sure that we're compatible in what we're doing. You know, someone had mentioned last week concerning, let me open up a page here. We've got... I wonder why that's not coming up that way. Let me try it another way here. Okay. Public Review. Okay, we have partnership with the Public Review, Republic Review. They're also referred to as Reclaiming the Republic. So we do support the work of Reclaiming the Republic, or again, the Republic Review, very much so. We are in perfect harmony with these individuals. It's actually one person, and I'm sure they've got other people working with him, but one person in particular that I've spoken with that really has put all this together here and is pursuing the Republic Review. And again, in conference, we had very little, if anything, to disagree upon, so... you know, again, we also connected with a few other groups. Robert Schultz with We the People. We haven't had too much contact with him lately, but hopefully soon we'll get together and talk with him again also. But he's willing, and we're willing to work with Robert. Robert is really done some amazing work with We the People. He's also called forth, I think it was 2008 or 2009, they called forth and did an election for the Third Continental Congress. We do have the work of the Third Continental Congress up on our website. I forget exactly where that's at. I'll have to check that page out because I know we had a lot of videos concerning that and what had taken place for that Third Continental Congress. And I think it was the paper that they wrote was 68 pages, which was commands to the government at every level, every state, and of course very particularly on the federal level, commanding them to be obedient to certain things and to, you know, focus and come back under the Constitution. Of course, they ignored that, but that's just one of the points. Matter of fact, we're going to use that as evidence in our case against the judiciary and others. Because we have to press them upon getting closer, you know, back under the Constitution. But anyway, I guess That's all I have to say about that. Again, that individual, Mark from the Lighthouse Liberty.club, which I will take a look at that. But if you can make contact with that person and connect them with Jan, Jan at NationalLibertyAlliance.org, and then Jan will make an arrangement for a meeting. And of course, anybody that wants to come to that meeting to listen in is welcome to that. It will be a recorded meeting. Okay, next question. You got your mic going. Huh?
It's working again.
Okay.
I think 2 to 3 years ago, Mark sent a lot of people to us over a period of time from his group.
Okay.
But that's the last I've heard from him. That's been a couple, 3 years ago.
But I've never had a personal conversation with him, have I?
No.
Recall. No. Okay. Well, if we've got contact information, let's contact him and see how he's doing, what he's doing, and, you know, we can support each other as long as we're, you know, again, compatible with our focus on what we're doing.
Okay. Next question, then. In regards to Aquaranto, is this effective on the state level? I am wanting to say yes. And how do I move a criminal case into the state Supreme Court if the judge ignores Aquaranto?
It works on every and any level. So, yes. And we're going to be talking about that tonight. So I'm not going to answer any more on that question because I think what we have to talk about is going to answer that question completely. So we'll pick up that on after the rest of these questions. Next question.
What would you say, this is still pertaining to Aquaranto, if the judge says that he doesn't have to answer the Aquaranto?
We're going to cover that too. So okay. We'll cover that in tonight's program.
Is the joinder only the federal level or is it also on the state level?
Well, the joinder is for a federal case against the judiciary. We're particularly assisting people and attaching cases, particularly for people who have had tax foreclosures, non-judicial foreclosures, shall I say, whether they're tax non-judicial foreclosures, mortgage non-judicial foreclosures, habeas corpuses, CPS, APS, particularly those cases. We might consider some of the cases. We have taken on a few other cases here or there. But we might consider some other cases. Right now, we don't really have anyone working the paperwork, but that, I think, is going to change soon. So anybody that's interested, they can start with the process of putting forms in. I know Jim is still gets the mail that comes through that, so do I and a few other people. And I'm sure Jim wouldn't mind at least taking on pulling the whatever... you know, forms are filled out and holding on to them until we get someone to pick that work up on us. So, okay, next question.
Are you only taking certain types of cases for the joinder?
Generally speaking, yes, but again, we might consider other cases.
Can you tell us what
we have to know what kind of case. Did they say what kind of case they got?
Yes. Yes. What kind of cases?
What do you mean? They want to know what kind of cases we're taking on?
For the joinder, yeah. And foreclosures and...
Yeah, we're taking the foreclosures, whether it's tax or whether it's mortgage. We're taking habeas corpuses, and we're also doing ABS and CPS. What's that? APS and CPS, yep. You know, we did do a couple of traffic, but we're really not interested in doing that. What we're going to cover tonight will help a lot of people in any case. And what we're going to be doing for the individuals who are joining us, we're going to be pursuing bonds and going after the officers of the court that have been violating our right of due process and using the court system to rob the people. So we're going to be going after all those people. But we need to have these people participating. If they're not participating, we're not participating with them then. And what I mean by that is, you know, they agreed, you know, we would help them. They agreed to be taking the classes that we put together, the courses. They agreed to, you know, keep in touch on what's going on in the Monday night programs, get educated, and to keep their ears open for announcements for when we start making a move, and we're making a move now as we speak. We're making a move. I think things are going to go a lot quicker than I thought. Last time I spoke about this, I said it could take a couple of months to put this together, but I don't think it's going to take that long. We're moving a lot quicker than I thought as far as pulling all our necessary paperwork together. It may take a couple of weeks or so to really run through all of the paperwork and put it together for filing and serving. But again, the people have to be part. We cannot chase a bond, oaths and bonds, on behalf of an individual if the individual isn't, you know, responding and participating, because they're the ones that have to, you know, work with us on the paperwork. We can't do that without them. So we can't represent them without them being here to be represented. So anybody that has a case in with us, you need to be paying attention, and we will be contacting everyone soon. We will try to contact everyone by phone, but we will be also contacting everybody by email after we contact them by phone to kind of wake them up, bring them to an alert for what we're doing, and then it's up to them to pay attention to email and respond to the meetings that we'll start having as soon as we get the paperwork together. Okay, next question.
I am concerned about the current movement by the Service Corp using the agencies to collect registration lists of food assets, now demanding that anyone maintaining a single chicken must register it. This is too far, and someone needs to challenge all these agency law-making powers. Can you file for a writ of quo warranto outside of the court setting? Registration implies transfer of title, which constitutes theft.
Okay, yes, we can file on these papers. Anybody that is elected or appointed, anybody that's an oath taker, okay, we're going to talk about that tonight, so we don't have to get into too much of the detail. I think tonight's program is going to answer those questions, and if not, then I'm sure we'll have questions after we're done concerning anything we might have missed. We do have a page put together on things we need to focus on a federal level. We should get some pages set up for things that need to be focused in on state levels by various states. That's, of course, going to be up to the individuals within the state to really kind of work to make a list of things that need to be fixed and done. You know, one of the key things that we spoke of a little bit about tonight, which, again, was under the START Committee of Safety, the Republic Review. The Republic Review is working from the state level to deal with a federal level to review the Republic, to review all legislation. It's a big job. We're pushing the states to come together to review the legislation on a federal level in order to get rid of anything that is unlawful, unconstitutional. We've got a lot of legislation that needs to be removed or deleted, or, well, I wouldn't say removed or deleted, but made
constitutional.
Well, anything that's unconstitutional. But we're not going to try to fix any unconstitutional legislation, but we definitely have to identify it and
make it void.
Pull it from outside of using it as being used as law in any way. And that's a big job. And again, that's being worked on by the Republic Review. And again, we support that. And I'm sure, you know, we're looking, well, he's looking, I'm sure, for individuals in different states to work with him. So hopefully some of our committees of safety will maybe attach to that group as they're working, because they can work then together on a federal level with that particular group. There's so much that needs to be fixed. Just things in life in general that are just very annoying because the government has made it that way. And so it's a huge list. But the key thing is anybody we support to be put into office, and anybody that is in office, through our committees of safety, we must require that these people know and obey the Constitution. As a matter of fact, I'm proposing, and I'm going to try to push this forward, and hopefully people will do this, we should require every single person running for office or asking for our support or is in office to come to National Liberty Alliance and take the courses. And then we will, we'll get into more detail on how we can work that out. They come and they can join. When they join, there is a button in there that they're an elected official or something like that. And then those individuals, when they take the course, we'll be able to see that they took the courses, and we can give them certificates that they had taken and completed these courses. And then that's the beginning. The beginning is understanding the Constitution. And you know, while we're on that point, let me just talk a little bit about that. I have been working on the course that's been shut down for a while, which is a civics course. And that civics course is so powerful. It really lays out American history, common law, and how we got to where we are today. It lays that out so clearly. And so anybody that hasn't taken that course should really be taking that course. And those people who are in the middle of that course and got stuck because it collapsed on us back in December, I think it was, let's say the beginning of this year, it kind of shut down. And I recently got involved in it and discovered that the problem was really a video problem connected mostly with YouTube. So somehow all of that has been disconnected. I've been working on that all week. And I think I could say by tomorrow morning I'm going to be working on this. So by tomorrow sometime, that civics course is going to be totally up and going. Now, you can enter into the civics course if you're just beginning. It is open now. It should be open. Let me just double check it. Let's see. Free civics course. Okay, let me just click on that and see what happens. Okay, registered as a grant. Okay, blah, blah, blah. Access is available. I do know that. I will double-check that with our tech tomorrow to make sure that is the case. All the videos should be attached tomorrow, reset up. All of them are up on Rumble. And that course should be up and going. But I want to tell you that the courses we put together are really powerful courses. The foundation study, which is sort of an introduction to the whole thing, powerful, powerful, powerful study. There are no questions in that study. It's just a series of videos. You go through the video and you come to the bottom and you click the button and you go to the next video. And you can come back at any time, you know. You can even stop a video midway and then come back and you'll be brought back to where you were left off. So that's just a study. It's a foundation study watching videos, and it'll prime you for exactly what we're going to be looking at, which is a study of the Constitution, American history, and the law, particularly common law. So the next study, the first course we have is the civics course. Then we have a government by consent course. We have a militia course. And then we have a jury administrator's accredited course. Now, all those courses are up and running and going, and everyone should take even the jury administrator's accredited course. It's a good course to take, even if you don't plan on becoming a jury administrator. Now, we did have a constitutional course. I don't see it up here. We're probably going to put that back on. It's sort of an introduction to the Constitution, sort of a 101. But it's more involved, and government by consent course is a much more involved course on the Constitution, more, you know, point by point, line by line course. But the Constitution is covered in all of these courses from different levels, and it starts right off in the very beginning, you know, with our civic course. So, okay, next question.
I see the FDA shut down a private Mennonite meat co-op operating in Pennsylvania, claiming the meat was not being processed to FDA standards. I don't have the power to tell you can't eat raw meat, so how can the agent claim a power the principal does not have? This common good interpretation goes far beyond the will of the people.
Well, look, the FDA is not doing their job. they really have been working for the elite, but it is the FDA is important to have. We need honest people, and we have to have our food protected. Clearly, when there's so much poison in our food, our water, our air, they're not doing their job at all. So we have to clean house on this whole thing. And it's up to Congress to fix these problems, and that's why we have to work on our elected officials. And then we have to hold them liable. We need to make a list of different items that we need for them to be looking into and cleaning up and fixing. And the FDA is one of them. I can't comment on this particular situation because maybe there is a problem with the food. Maybe there isn't. I don't know. I know raw milk is a problem with the FDA, but it appears that raw milk is much more healthier, from what I understand, than the pasteurized milk, of course. You know, once something is pasteurized, it's heated up, and it destroys the vitamins inside of it. You know, orange juice is also heated up to a certain temperature, and it destroys the vitamin C in it. So that is a problem. But I'm not knowledgeable enough about these things. We do have to really push on them and identify people who are knowledgeable. There are plenty of people out there. We can find them on Rumble. We can find them even on YouTube and various other places who are experts in this area, that area, or another area when it comes to particularly food. So, but we'll have to work on that collectively as a group of people and figure these problems out. So it's something that needs to be discussed and figured out and dealt with. Next question.
I am in communication with the county tax assessor here in Mecklenburg County, North Carolina. I filed a notarized declaration 10 years ago with the clerk of deeds, concerning my demand for lawful money. This should count as an appearance before an agent of or the trustee by which said trustee is required to return title of my estate to me. The Constitution does not authorize the government to levy a direct tax on labor or property, so this would appear to be an attempt by the assessor to deny me my right to own property. What say you?
Well, of course, that's correct. It's an uphill battle. It can be won. And again, what we're going to be talking about tonight is one of the ways that you can go dealing with this problem. But bear in mind, I personally feel we shouldn't put too much, time and too much energy into some of these things, because they're all going to be corrected once we get to the other side of devolution. And anybody that's watching what's going on, we see things are heating up, and I think we're extremely close. So we'll see how that works out. But a lot of these problems will be worked out. The biggest problem we have is the ignorance of people. And I speak to myself first, but I have done something about it, and everyone else needs to do something about it, and that it requires them to have an education. We need to get a proper education back into our schools, but we also need to get a proper education back inside of us. And one of the biggest problems is that people don't seem to read anymore, and we have to read. And one of the other problems that people have is self-control, to force themselves to do what they have to do, create new habits. You know, habits are hard to break, but for those who don't have good self-control, it's a very simple thing. It's hard for the first week or two or three when you're trying to break a bad habit. But it's easy to execute and realize, because it's only a matter of talking to yourself and commanding yourself, maybe making some notes and of the things that you have to change in your life. Education is one, self-control to read. A lot of people seem to just don't read. Well, they go out on the internet, they read there, but everything's in little tweets, a little here, a little there. Nobody really reads. We need to sit down and read. You know, the courses we put together hopefully will bring people, and we've got a lot of videos up there, so it does make it a lot easier. But it should bring us to the point eventually where we start to read, because we have a further education, a higher education after the courses. Going underneath the education starts here. We have so many things here. You know, we have the 5,000-year leap, which is easy reading, but we have the book, which is both in audio and in PDF form, so you can read along and listen at the same time. You can listen and read along at the same time. The Federalist Papers and the Anti-Federalist Papers, we have that in PDF and also in MP3s. So again, you can be listening in and reading along with these both of these papers. Take some notes, make some bullet points, and just keep educating yourself, filling yourself with these things. The most important thing is to have government by consent, and that is the big problem. We don't have government by consent. Let me restate that. We in America do not have government by consent because the people do not know how to have government by consent. And that's the purpose of what we're doing here, creating committees of safety. Now, I don't have an accurate count, and this is an old count, but the last count I had was 121 committees of safety already executed and in process in one way or another. You know, in certain in counties throughout America. So there's 121 of them working. And I got to believe at this point there's a lot more than that. And that's what we need to be doing. I'll be sending out an email here in New York, and eventually I'll probably do the same thing in Pennsylvania, in Connecticut, and maybe New Jersey, and maybe a few other states close by here on the Northeast, where I'm willing to travel to give the seminar on committees of safety to help people to get started. You know, here in New York, we have 670 members. So with 670 members, you know, we can get a lot of committees of safety going. We need to get this going. And anybody else that gets themselves educated enough might want to do the same thing to assist other people and, you know, work with the national level. We'll help connect you with all of the individuals within your state that are busy working, getting committees of safety going. We'll make contact with all of the people within the state that are members of the National Liberty Alliance and let it be known that there's a person interested in assisting them by maybe working to give the first seminar or an introductory to get committees of safety started in various counties throughout the state. We all have to get involved doing this because that's the problem. The problem, I think, soon will no longer be that we can't have government by consent. It's a matter of having government by consent, and that requires the people to recognize that they need to become educated in order to have government by consent. As Jefferson said, if a people expect to be ignorant and free, forget about it. You know, you cannot be, of course, to a paraphrase. They expect what never was and never will be. Okay, next question.
Okay, not sure if this is the correct venue to see about assistance on a foreclosure ruling. I just received the notice on Saturday and supposedly only have 10 days from the date of the order. This was not a normal foreclosure process. Fraud existed on the seller side and such. Plus, the system here in Arkansas is very corrupt, and they have no jurisdiction over the property or me. I need to get some direction, assistance, and if there are any formats I can use for appeal or challenge the decision of the court. Also, they did not ever answer an affidavit of return, in fact, under perjury, and it's as if it's nothing to do with it. So I can file a judgment against them, even though the case is supposedly closed. Can it be reopened or such? Sorry about the questions. I'm just trying to find people that can help me in Arkansas and also in Kentucky regarding trustees violating trustee responsibilities. This property is not just my home. It's the home of our wellness business, which saves people's lives every day.
All right. I don't know what they mean by they say it's closed. I don't know when this took place, how long ago, and have they had any court hearings, which would be non-judicial foreclosure hearings anyway. It's not really, but there'd be a hearing. They have to make it look good as if it's going to court. So I don't know where they're at, but they could do a joinder. again, hopefully we'll be working through joined us shortly. I think we might have the people, the personnel able to work the paperwork with me to get some other foreclosures out there. And also, you can follow what we're going to be talking about tonight as a process, trying to deal with your problem yourself if you want. Okay, next question.
I have finished all the exams on the courses offered by NLA to become a jury administrator. I have also clicked on the link that indicates that I want to become a jury administrator and have submitted it. What is the next move in the process?
Did they say they completed all the courses?
Right.
Okay. Well, we're going to make available soon a paper, you know, that certifies them that they had taken all the courses and is qualified as a jury administrator. And we're going to be talking to jury administrators soon. Again, it's something that's on our list. We have about 1,200 people or 1,100 people. We've got a lot of people who are interested in that. And so we're going to try to make contact with all these people and you know, kind of reactivate a lot of people that are not active at the moment and see once whether they're still interested and starting to have meetings for that process. You know, that's not going to be executed until after devolution. So I'm kind of hoping and thinking that maybe January, February, you know, the coming new year, is when we'll be hopefully moving into that kind of a power. And it must take place. It must happen at some point. And I think, again, the beginning of the year might be that time period because I think devolution is going to be playing out at the end of this year. Things are going to be a big changeover next year. All right, next question.
Last question, John. Last week, John was starting to address a question regarding Biden's Executive Order 14067 that is set to take effect in December of this year. John started to stray off into discussion surrounding cryptocurrency such as Bitcoin, which is not pertaining to the subject. The question's main intention was to seek recourse in the event all currency was transitioned into digital form, with a social credit score prerequisite in order to transact. That portion of the question was left unanswered. Any comments would be appreciated.
Yeah, I don't believe that that's going to happen. I think we're going to go back to constitutional money. I don't think, I know we're going to go back to constitutional money. And it's up to the people to make sure it happens. Again, we get back to the Committee of Safety. Every answer to every problem gets back to the Committee of Safety. All politics is local. Remember that. All politics is local. This digital thing is insane. Gold and silver is constitutional money. We must get back to that. Any coin that has been coined by the United States always has its full value according to the time that you're spending it. Inflation or deflation, the coin goes up and the coin goes down. In other words, that holds. So if we come to a collapsed society, we come back to gold and silver, every coin that you have in your pocket will have face value of that monies at that point in time. Give you an example, okay? If you have a silver dollar, okay, and it doesn't even have to be silver inside. It could be a little copper, it could be a little silver, it could be a little this, a little that. It doesn't matter. It could be steel. It doesn't matter. It's being printed or coined, shall I say, by the U.S. Treasury. And therefore, they have to give its face value at the time in gold or silver, ultimately, at the time when things change over to real money. So, again, to give an example, if you went to the bank and got a box of halves, it's half dollars. So a box of half dollars, it cost you $500. Okay. Now the dollar right now is valued at about two. It has a real value of about 2 cents. That's about all it's worth. $1 is worth about 2 cents. And once the economy goes, once the things go back to real money, that $500 becomes $500,000. Now let me double check my math, because if we take 500, okay, and let's see how we would do this. 0.02, 25,000. If we take $500, okay, and we divide it by 0.02, which is 2 cents, and it equals 25,000. That's the value, the face value of that coin. In other words, not that it's going to be worth $25,000, it'll be worth $500 in its own time. And if there's no inflation, you'd be able to buy $25,000 worth of product that you would be able to buy today with $25,000 with $500 at that point in time, after we're back to gold and silver, to constitutional money. So I say your best investment is coins. Doesn't matter what coins they are, nickels, dimes, quarters. We do know nickel is the original makeup. It's got 75% nickel and 25% copper. And that's the way nickel always has been. That has never changed. So it's got, its proper value in metal anyway. And when you get coins, particularly halves, you'll find some silver dollars in there. Some of them will be 40%, some of them will be 90%. And I think there's even some with a little less. But even the halves, they have copper. They might have a tint of silver in there, but usually copper and some other things. But it doesn't matter. Again, face value, it's U.S. coins. The note, the dollar note, Federal Reserve note, that's worthless. But I do think that there'll be some kind of an appreciation for it, because once they seize all of the assets of all these people, and there are a lot of people and a lot of assets that's going to be seized, well, then that money has to go to restore the people. So I'm not sure how they'll figure. There's a couple of ways I can think of figuring it out, but it would only be a guess. I'm sure it'll be worked out. There is a paper out there. I'm trying to think of the name of the paper. I don't have it in front of me right now. So, but there was a paper or something that was served on Congress, so they claim, and I don't know how true that is. And Congress was forced to sign it, and they did sign it, which does bring something back to the value of money. Again, brings us back to some kind of a value, a restitution. But again, how that's going to work, I don't know. But we do know a couple of things. Gold and silver, definitely going to be worth something. Any coin, any U.S. coin, definitely going to be worth its face value at the time. Inflation, deflation, whatever it is. So that'll all have its value. The other coin, that a lot of people are buying and getting involved in, I understand that price has been falling, the value of that particular coin. But what's that coin called again, Jan? That a lot of people have got going into?
Which court?
Bitcoin, I think it's called. Yeah, Bitcoin. Isn't it Bitcoin?
I don't know, John.
Well, what, read on the paper, didn't they bring up Bitcoin in there?
Oh, yes, you did mention Bitcoin.
Okay, Bitcoin is backed by the same thing the Federal Reserve dollar is backed by. Absolutely nothing. And anything backed by nothing in history always fails. So I would not invest a penny into Bitcoin. Invest in U.S. coins. That's what you invest in. So anyway, that's the last question?
That was all, John.
Okay. Okay, by the way, is Brent here tonight? I haven't seen him here for quite a few weeks.
I didn't see him yet.
Okay. All right, I'm going to move forward here. What I want to look at, we talked a little bit about last week, and we're going to take some time tonight to get into this, because I think this is really important. And you can find this information under Education Starts here, comes down to Law, and then come over to click on Court Forms and Process. All right. And in here, as I mentioned earlier, you can get that land patent paper. But we put together Corwanto, and we put together a notice and demand for oath and bond if you're not in court. If you're in court, you use a quo warranto. If you're dealing with some bureaucrat and you're not in court, you use a notice and demand for oath and bond. And then the third part of that, which I posted yesterday, is oath and bond enforcement. Okay, it's the beginning of the process of enforcement on that oath and bond. And so we're going to talk about all three of these papers. And there'll be a little bit that we're not going to talk about, which is really approaching the bond company and dealing with that. That's what we're going to have to talk another time, hopefully maybe next week, because I don't have all the information on that yet. But as far as this is concerned, you know, make a notice of the fact that you want them to produce their oaths and bonds, and also the fact that you want it to be enforced, that they put it up, okay? If someone asks the question, what if the judge or the person says, I don't have to give it to you? Well, there is enforcement, and we're going to talk about enforcement to force them to give it to you. And they don't have a choice, and we'll talk about how that is. But let's first look at the quo warranto. We have this both in PDF and in DocX, which is Microsoft Word. Microsoft Word, you know, is easy to be able to manipulate. Whatever, you know, footnotes are in there, you can cut and paste and copy it into, into another notepad, you know, Word, and add or whatever you want to do with it. But the point is it takes all the information and cuts and pastes with all the footnotes. PDFs don't. But for people who don't have Microsoft Word, which anybody can have that for free these days anyway, but I put the PDF. So let's look at the quo warranto. I did read a little bit of this last week, but I'm going to read this whole thing, and then we're going to look at the next document and see where we go from here. Basically, this is looking as if you're in a court. Okay, it doesn't matter. It could be a city court, a town court, a village court, a state court, a county court. It doesn't matter. Okay, and it could be even a federal court. The only difference between enforcement in a federal court and with a situation in a federal court versus a enforcement of a situation in a state court or a county court or a city court or a town court, et cetera. The only difference is if you're already in the federal court and the judge refuses to give his documents, then you pursue it through the appellate process. Otherwise, if you're in any other court, you pursue it through the federal court, and the federal judiciary should be obedient to that, and that also could be pushed up to the next court if necessary. But we'll talk about that at the end of this. So it's a matter of filling out the paperwork accordingly, put your name in here, the individuals, the court individuals. In the case, again, of outside the court, you know, we have another paper. Let me just open that up at the same time, which is a notice and demand for identification and credentials. This is if you're not in a court. So you petition an individual and you're responding, and they're the respondents, you're the petitioner. And basically the wording, a lot of the wording is pretty much the same, so I'm not going to read much through here. than it is on the quo warranto. It's very close. There is some changes because there's not a judge involved and usually not a lawyer involved, or at least not a lawyer that's an officer of the court at the time. But anybody, again, on the notice and demand would be anybody that is on the level of town, city, state, anybody that's a bureaucrat, but you're outside the court. All right, so let's look at the quo warranto. This is a writ quo warranto and supporting memorandum of law, which is an administrative notice and demand for identification and credentials. On and for the record, this good faith presentment pursuant to the First and Ninth Amendment petition for redress of grievances is presented by said petitioners to the said respondents named above, located at the above said court for the purpose of obtaining full disclosure, identification under and determining under what authority, venue of office, and capacity the recipient appears to conduct public business in approaching the presenter. This administrative notice, supported by memorandum of law attached, duly served on you and deemed actual constructive and sufficient notice, requires that you provide to the presenter within 10 business days from the time of presentment copies of below listed documents, said copies to be certified under penalty of perjury and exemplified in accordance with one statute 122 and two stat 298 and Federal Rules Civil Procedures, Rules 902 under Article 6 of the Constitution of the United States of America. Number one, oath of office, and we give a quotation of where this is required. But anyway, oath of office, office official surety bond, letter of appointment form, if applicable, registration statement, delegation of authority affidavit, loyalty and security clearance, employee affidavit, if applicable, and economic statement of interest. You are hereby compelled to answer under 28 U.S.C. 13, subsection 1361. Excuse me. Your failure, refusal, and nor neglect to fully and timely comply will set for the record as, and timely comply will set for the record as ultimate facts that you have failed to qualify for the office and therefore are acting without lawful authority, office, and or capacity as an officer, official, or agent of any original jurisdiction, non-corporate, governmental, state, or federal agency. It is presumed and or assumed that it is your sworn affirmed duty and fiduciary obligation to provide the above information in a timely and truthful manner. Please be aware of what the federal courts have held in U.S. versus Tweel. Silence can only be equated with fraud where there is a legal or moral duty to speak or where an inquiry left unanswered would intentionally be misleading. This administrative notice and demand is not intended to hinder, delay, obstruct, intimidate, or in any way threaten anyone, but is simply a means of invoking recipient's duty to act pursuant to the above-quoted statutes, which apply to the recipient or recipient's office official capacity for lawful disclosure of virtually needed information, vitally needed information. This demand is made consistent with the United States Supreme Court decision of Federal Corp Insurance Corporation versus Merrill, and the intent and the inherent mandatory duty of honest services by a public servant of the people. Should recipient not timely and fully comply in 10 days, it'll be deemed by tactic proclamation your implied admission that you have failed to qualify for your office or employment pursuant to the principle of law embodied in the decision of Norton versus Lewis. Wherefore, the aforesaid judicial officer is to place in the record or of this court and mail the same to the plaintiff, the aforesaid demands. Respectfully submitted, a seal. If you don't have a seal, the word seal is sufficient enough. Your name is petitioner. Now, the memorandum of law that's connected to this, I'm going to read through this. Now, again, I'm not going to read through the paper that is a notice and demand, okay, on an individual that is not in a court but is a person, a bureaucrat of some kind. But it's usually an oath taker, you know, someone who has taken an oath. That's the person you have to go after. For instance, if you're dealing with a clerk, it could be a clerk that is not the individual that was appointed or elected, but you have to go after the individual that is appointed or elected, so you have to demand dealing with that person. So that's the person you'd go after. But anyway, the wording on here is very close to the same, but it just has some changes because there's no judge involved and no lawyer involved. Okay, memorandum of law, which is part of this quo vanto. So this is page 3 of 6, memorandum of law, 36 U.S.C. 306, national motto, In God We Trust, is the national motto. The purpose of this memorandum is to remind the judges and all officers of the court and all public officials of their obligation to faithfully perform their duties under oath with integrity by upholding the law of the land, also known as common law or natural law, whereas their mandatory bonds guaranteed against the public official's fraud or dishonesty and covers losses arising from neglect or omission. The public official's bond, a statutory obligation requiring faithful performance. A public official's bond refers to an instrument by which a public officer and a secondary obligator undertake to pay up a fixed amount of money if the officer does not faithfully discharge his duties or his or her or of his or her office. A statutory public official's bond is thus a public official bond mandate by statute. Black's Law Dictionary defines official bond as a bond given by a public officer conditioned on the faithful performance of the duties of the office. In the three-party surety structure, the public or official is the principal. The bonding company is the surety, sometimes called the second obligor, and the government, or in many cases the public being served by the official, is the obligee. Statutory bond requirements are found within the individual state codes. They are typically interspersed throughout the code, although there is typically a public official or public office chapter that has the general bond requirements and procedures, as well as the authority for the issuance of such bonds. The requirements for the various individual officials, however, are found within the specific chapter relating to their office. In general, bonds for public office that are required by statute, hereafter official bonds, or public official bonds, are mandatory for all elected and most public officials. This can range from a governor to local school board members. Statutes may require an official bond for an individual public official, or may allow a blanket bond for a group of officials, such as the members of the board of directors. Depending on the statutory language, an official bond may be a faithful performance bond, a fidelity bond, public employee blanket bond, or public employee dishonesty policy. While faithful performance bonds are by far the most common official bonds, the others may also be statutorily required. Now, just a quick thing. They talk about blanket coverage, and I used to think that was a bad thing, but then I come to realize what they're really talking about is this. They still, you know, the people have to come up with some money to pay for a bond. And a lot of people can't get bonded, because, and a lot of people run for office, then maybe they can't get bonded. They're not in a position. Maybe they don't have enough assets even to secure what is necessary for a bond. But it's sort of like an insurance policy. They pay a certain amount, and it comes out of a, you know, sort of a big kitty of all the monies that are collected. And so the state sort of sponsors that. And I think that's okay. I don't really see a problem with that. They still have to come up with their financials, their assets, and they have to report every year, I think, on that. So annually, they have to make a report, and as their assets grow, or they buy a house or this or that, they have to put those assets up. They have to serve notice within their financials. But again, they still have to pay for that bond. A certain amount of money has to come in. However, they might collect that, you know, it may be that they are on payments, or maybe they have to come up with a lump sum. I don't know. That they work out, however they work that out. Okay, so I want to just make that point. Statutory bonds, by definition, official bonds are required within the statute, so dictates. Often the bond is required to be effective before or upon the taking of the oath of office by the employee or official. So the process has to be at least in motion. In other cases, an official bond may run indefinitely, covering each successive employee or official as they take office. The statute will either mandate or authorize the procurement of a bond. If the controlling statutory language merely authorizes the issuance of a bond, that bond will only be a statutory official bond to the extent the language of the bond reflects the requirements and intent of the statute. In Price versus Arundel, a bond was procured by the government entity to protect itself from losses caused by employees' failure to perform their duties. Because the bond did not meet criteria set forth in the authorizing statute, it was held to be a non-statutory bond, not subject to the provisions of a code affecting official bonds. The public official bond is commonly issued to protect against conduct or admission by the named public official that constitutes a breach of the public official's duty of office. These bonds guarantee against more than the public official's fraud or dishonesty, and in certain cases can cover loss arising from neglect or omissions. A public official's bond may be issued for the benefit of the governmental unit in which the principal holds office, but also it can provide coverage to the general public. The bond is in the nature of an indemnity bond rather than a penal or forfeiture bond. It is, in effect, a contract between the officer and the government binding the officer to discharge the duties of his or her office. The official bond is not intended to protect the principal or the public official himself, but rather to intended to protect the city or the entire citizenship served by the official. The official bond indemnifies those who have suffered a loss as a result of officials' misconduct. And in many cases, the state statute will include the provision specifically allowing a member of the public to bring suit against the bond if that individual has suffered a loss resulting from the official misconduct. To that end, while there is some varying degree to specificity in the statutory requirements, almost all satisfy the general purpose of requiring an official to issue a bond for the faithful performance of his or her duty. An official bond is taken as assurance of compliance with the law. It is designed to ensure that the official or employee will faithfully perform his or her duties while in office. Now, code of conduct, and this is focusing particularly on judges, so this section is not, you won't find that in the memorandum for the notice and demand for an individual bureaucrat or whatever, dealing with that individual outside of the court. Again, this is focusing in on people in the court offices. So, code of conduct. The code of conduct, and there's footnotes in here, by the way. I'm not making note of those footnotes, but there are footnotes supporting everything we're saying here. The code of conduct for United States judges include the ethical canons that apply to federal judges and provides guidance on the performance of officials' duties and engagement in a variety of outside activities. Anyone who is an officer of the federal judicial system authorized to perform judicial function is a judge for the purpose of this code. All judges should comply with this code. Canon number one. A judge should uphold the integrity and independence of the judiciary. An independent and an honorably judiciary is indispensable to justice in our society. A judge should maintain and enforce high standards of conduct and should personally observe those standards so that integrity and independence of the judiciary may be preserved. The provisions of this code should be construed and applied to further that object. Canon number two. A judge should avoid impropriety and the appearance of impropriety in all activities. A judge should respect and comply with the law and should act at all times in a manner that promotes public confidence in integrity and impartiality of the judiciary. A judge should not allow family, social, political, financial, or other relationships to influence judicial conduct or judgment. A judge should neither lend the prestige of the judicial office to advance the private interest of the judge or others, nor convey or permit others to convey the impression that they are in special position to influence the judge. A judge should not testify voluntarily as a character witness. A judge should not hold membership in any organization that practices invidious discrimination on the basis of race, sex, religion, or national origin. This membership should expand to the Bar Association, too, because that affects their rulings, doesn't it? Canon number three, a judge should perform the duties of the office fairly, impartially, and diligently. The duties of the judicial office take precedence over all other activities. The judge should perform those duties with respect for others and should not engage in behavior that is harassing, abusive, prejudice, or bias. A judge should be faithful to and maintain professional confidence in the law and should not be swayed by partisan interest, public clamor, or fear of criticism. A judge should hear and decide matters assigned unless disqualified and should maintain order and decorum in all judicial proceedings. A judge should be patient, dignified, respectful, and courteous to litigants, jurors, witnesses, lawyers, and others with whom the judge deals in an official capacity. Canon number four. Complete separation of the judge from extrajudicial activities is neither possible nor wise. A judge should not become isolated from the society in which the judge lives. As a judicial officer and a person specifically learned in the law, a judge is in a unique position to contribute to the law, the legal system, and the administration of justice, including revising substantive and procedural law and improving criminal and juvenile justice to the extent that the judge's time permits and impartiality is not compromised. The judge is encouraged to do so either independently or through a bar association, judicial conference, or other organization dedicated to the law. Subject to the same limitation, judges may also engage in a wide range of non-law related activities. Canon number 5. A judge should refrain from political activities. A judge should not act as a leader or hold office or hold any office in a political organization, make speeches for a political organization or candidate, or publicly endorse or oppose a candidate for public office, or solicit funds for, pay an assessment to, or make a contribution to a political organization or character or candidate, to attend or purchase a ticket for a dinner or other event sponsored by a political organization or candidate. Professional conduct. A lawyer, as a member of the legal profession, is a representative of a client and an officer of the legal system with special responsibility for the quality of justice. As an officer of the legal system, each lawyer has a duty to uphold the legal process, to demonstrate respect for the legal system, to seek improvement of the law, and to promote access to the legal system and the administration of justice. In addition, a lawyer should further the public's understanding of and confidence in the rule of law and the justice system, because in a constitutional republic, you have a duty to uphold justice, even above the law. The relative autonomy of a legal profession carries with it a special responsibilities of self-governance. Each lawyer is responsible for observing the true rules of professional conduct established through reason. The rules of law must always be governed by morals founded on common law maxims and guided by ethics. Oath of office. Article 6 of the Constitution states that other officials, including members of Congress, shall be bound by oath or affirmation to support this Constitution. An officer within 30 days after the effective date of his appointment shall file with the oath of office required by Section 3331 of this title an affidavit that neither he nor anyone acting in his behalf has given, transferred, promised, or paid any consideration for or in the expectation of a hope of receiving assistance in securing the appointment. 5 U.S.C. subsection 3331, oath of office, an individual except the president elected or appointed to the office of honor or profit in the civil service of uniformed services shall take the following oath. I, or the oath taker, do solemnly swear or affirm that I will support and defend the Constitution of the United States against all enemies, foreign and domestic, that I will bear true faith and allegiance to the same, that I will take this obligation freely without any mental reservation or purpose or evasion, and that I will well and faithfully discharge the duties of this office on which I am about to enter, so help me God. This section does not affect the oaths required by law. Okay, so that's the whole thing. It's not really a lot. It lays out the code of conduct for the judge and the requirement of the conduct for professional conduct for the other officers of the court. Specifically, we're talking about the attorneys. Okay, so this memorandum, again, of law is part of this whole writ quo wanta. Now, what happens if the judge, after 10 days, and I would count, I think it's calendar days, I think it says that, I'd give them full working days, even though it's calendar days. I think it is calendar days. But give them 10 weekdays. And so you're sure that you're giving them a few extra days at that point before you go for the next part of the process. And the next part of the process is found oath and bond enforcement. I'll open up the PDF. Okay, now this is 3 pages. Basically, it should be to the United States District Court for the whatever district, in my case, is Southern District of New York. So you have to find out whatever federal district court you're in and file the paperwork there. But I don't think that's really a necessity. I think you can file it in any district you want, actually. But generally speaking, you would file it in your district. And if you're in a federal district court and have a problem with a federal judge, then this would be to the appellate court, okay? And this is a motion to move to the federal district court to comply, to compel obedience. And so I'll read this quick as I can. The district court shall have original jurisdiction under 28 U.S.C. subsection 1361 of any action in the nature of mandamus to compel an officer or an employee of the United States or any agency thereof to perform duty owed to the plaintiff. So again, this is a U.S. code, and they are the ones you got to go to the federal courts in order to compel the obedience. So again, if you're in court, whatever court you're in, you're going to take it to the federal court. This is the cause, and they're required under 28 U.S.C. 1361 to comply and enforce it. They don't have a choice. They don't have a choice. And if they failed, you can file papers with them and move up the line with it. And so anyway, whereas the above said officer in the whatever court failed to answer in a timely manner the administrative notice in the form of a writ quo warranto, and of course that would be changed over in a form of a notice and demand, so you have to figure that out as you go on. You might have to change that if you're outside the court. Supported by memorandum of law, see attached, and you have attachment to this paper, whatever you filed in the other court. This demand was made consistent with the United States Supreme Court decision of Federal Crop Insurance Corporation versus Merrill, and the inherent mandatory duty of honest services by a public servant of the people, and in accordance with 1 Stat 122 and 2 Stat 298 and Federal Civil Procedure Rule 902 under Article 6 of the Constitution of the United States, for the United States of America. Implementing a meaningful way for the public to be protected from judicial misconduct and denial of due process is vital. There must be review and remedy. To quote former United States President Theodore Roosevelt, "No man is above the law, no man is below it, nor do we ask any man's permission when we ask him to obey it. Obedience to the law is demanded as a right, not asked as a favor." The judges who administered justice in our republic must be seen as ethical and subject to meaningful correction when it is necessary. Nothing less than the rule of law is at stake. Judicial misconduct breaks down the very fiber of what is necessary for a functional judiciary. The judiciary cannot exist without the trust and confidence of the people. Judges must therefore be accountable to the legal and ethical standard. The judiciary is built on the foundation of a public faith. They make rulings on the law, rulings that the people must believe came from competent, lawful, and independent judicial officers. Judicial misconduct comes in many forms. The ethical standards addressed problematic actions, omissions, and relationships that delete public confidence. In this case, the presiding judge ruling are so far afield of American jurisprudence, said rulings violated, number one, violated petitioner's right of due process protected by the Fifth Amendment. Number two, ignored the federal rules of civil procedure, in particular Rule 55 and 60 that govern court procedures for a default in the civil case in order to rescue the defendants, whereas the U.S. attorney joined the breach of the rule of law and jurisprudence when said attorney, having a duty to speak, remained silent in the presence of these violations. Silence can only be equated with fraud when there is a legal or moral duty to speak, or where an inquiry left unanswered would be intentionally misleading. Now, it's important to note here that number two is put in there if they're pursuing Rule 55 and 60 to try to A, throw you out of the court, or the other cuts on the other side of things, if they defaulted. I have two cases where defaulted take place by U.S. attorneys. So if they have defaulted and the judge rescued them from that default to bring them back into the system only to throw you out, okay, I mean, that's what happened with me in two cases, and I'm pursuing that right now in this fashion. So it's important to realize that on number two. I probably should make a note on that. Okay, number three, both the judge and the U.S. attorney collaborated to hijack the petitioner to jurisdictions unknown, while said judge denied the petitioner the right to know the jurisdiction by which the court is acting. Whereas the lawyer requires that a court must prove on the record all jurisdictional facts related to the jurisdiction asserted. Remember, there's footnotes proving all these things. Number four, said judge denied my request to state on the record the jurisdiction of the court, whereas a court must prove on the record all the jurisdiction facts related to the jurisdiction asserted. The law requires proof of jurisdiction to appear on the record of the administrative agency and all administrative proceedings. And a third, no judicial process whatsoever, whatever form it may assume, can have any lawful authority outside of the limits of the jurisdiction of the court or judge by whom it is issued. And an attempt to enforce it beyond these boundaries is nothing less than lawless violence. Now, we've got the U.S. cases quoted here on all these 3 points. Number five, violated petitioner's right of a trial in a court of record. Remember, they took me out of a court of record and brought me into jurisdictions jurisdictions unknown. So they violated petitioner's right of a trial in a court of record. USC 28, subsection 43A. There shall be in each circuit a court of appeals, which shall be a court of record. So if you're going into a court of appeals, that's got to be a court of record. There shall be in each judicial district a district court, which shall be a court of record, known as the United States District Court for the District. So every court you go into in a federal level is a court of record. Could be a court of equity, but we're looking at courts of record. That's what the people come into, courts of record. People who are working under commercial activities or working for an agency, a federal agency, a government agency, they come in under equity. That's not for us. We're not governed by any of their positive laws. And positive law is a good name for this. They're supposed to be really, under the common law, and they're supposed to be positive. They're supposed to give equity. They're supposed to give justice. And, of course, they're not doing that, but that's what really equity is really meaning. It's positive law, that is to give equity, to give justice in a court, ultimately running under the rules of common law, and the whole process needs to be under American jurisprudence. Wherefore, the aforesaid judicial officers must be compelled to answer said writ quo warranto on the record and mail the same to the plaintiff, respectively submitted, the date, name of petitioner, and the seal. Okay, so that covers all of those papers. Now, the next step, once the judge requires that information to flow, see, if they don't want it, they don't want to do it, they refuse, you enforce it. And you force it under the federal code. And then once they produce this information on the record, the next step takes place, and that's making contact with the bonding company. Now, that's the next step. I haven't worked that out yet. I'm hoping to work that out in the next week or so. I'm hoping to have a meeting with an individual, hopefully this week, in order to really get straight on this and start to look for some examples and put something together and get another form up there, which, again, will assist us. And that should be the final thing at that point, because then it becomes an administrative decision within the process of the bonding company, and then a certain allotment of damages is then given. How that works out, what the amounts are, I don't know yet. I'm going to find out, and I'll get that out. So I'm trying to make this as simple as possible. There is another way to pursue this, okay, and to get some assistance in this. I think their paperwork is a little wordy. When I first started writing papers, I was very wordy. I'd put tons and tons and tons of information and proof to really put the pressure down. But I sometimes, too many words, sometimes it's better with less words than more words. Let's put it that way. And again, if I'm going to pile a lot of information, I'm just going to summarize my conclusion of whatever it is I'm trying to do in my paper, and then attach a memorandum, which could get very wordy, to make and support my position, which comes with a conclusion, and that conclusion is inside the paperwork. So this way it keeps your paperwork clean. It doesn't have too much stuff. People don't get lost in it trying to read it and go through it. So memorandums are important to work with, memorandums of law. You always come, the purpose of this memorandum is for A, B, and C, and at the end, the conclusion of this memorandum is, A, B, C. And that's what you're putting in is your conclusion, and you're offering the proof of that conclusion in your main form of paperwork. You're offering that proof in the memorandum, which is attached, named, and numbered. Let me see. Okay, so if you come in here and you wanted to, there's another way you can go about this. And you'd come in under start a committee of safety. We put bonds for the winds here. Okay, now this is a group of people who work things out from many states. They're mostly chasing people on the school board level or the local government level, which is okay. And if you want to do it another, this is just another way of doing it. Again, I've read through their paperwork. I think it's very wordy. I think they don't need as much words, but it's not that it's not true, and they have value and they have clout. So if you want to go that route, they can help you. They offer to hold your hand through the process. They don't charge you anything. They're just trying to get the government to be obedient. The same thing that National Liberty Alliance is doing, trying to get the government to be obedient. So anyway, you can work through this. I've laid out the basic information from their website. I put together the videos and tried to give a nice logical flow of how this works, serving a letter of intent, filing a claim, and so on. Matter of fact, I may look into their filing a claim and see how they're doing it. I've listened to the video. It's been a while ago, but I'm going to look at some of their paperwork. But then we've given the, web addresses where you can get a bond request letter, where you get the letter of intent, where you can learn to file a claim. And then you can join Bonds for Wind on Telegram. They have a Telegram group going on for help and help you stay up with the latest news and the winds. So again, there's a couple of ways you could do this. If you're in the court, I strongly suggest doing it our way, but you can do whatever way you want. Now, again, when we come to questions tonight, if anybody's going to ask any questions concerning the amount of money or anything, information on filing with the bond company, I don't have those answers yet. Everything is, I'm just surmising a lot of things at this point at that level. So when I get everything accurately put together and confident in what I've got and get a paper written, which would be a letter that would go to the bonding company. Then the next step after that would be the hearing, okay? And then the decision of the bonding company. So anyway, that's what we'll work from there. All right, that brings us to the end of this. So we'll open up for questions. Anybody's got any questions? Get into the queue of star 6 and 1 if you're on a phone. If you come in on an app or any other way, there should be a little button to get you into the queue. So let's take, we only got a couple people in the queue, so, anybody wants to get into the queue, now's the time. Okay, let us take Ross. Ross, you got the mic. Go right ahead, Ross. Ross, you've been unmuted. Go right ahead. Hello, Ross. All right, maybe Ross walked away from his computer. I'll just mute his mic if I can find it. Hang on a second. Where's his mic at? All right, maybe I'll leave his mic open. I can't find a way to mute him. And we'll call him back in a minute. Okay, let's take our other caller, Andromina. Go right ahead. You got the mic. And again, nobody else in the queue, so if anybody's got anything, get into the queue.
Hey, John.
How you doing, Andromina?
All right. Okay, one of the questions you did answer already now, so my other question is, now, did you say, now remember, in the CEPAS cases, you got the situation where you got the federal judge, okay, who understand that, I understand that part, but now you got, the defendants, state judges, so far as you know, what do we do with them?
I think what you're trying to say is if you're going after individuals, you're dealing with the bonds with the court officers, but you still have the case itself. So this whole process is to put their feet into the fire here, requiring them to be obedient and make them pay for their denial of due process and their assault upon you in so many ways in that courtroom, and bring them back to the point of letting this case go forward. At that point, they'll have to recuse themselves. Another judge would have to come in. And that judge, you would think, would have enough common sense to say, okay, let's get this case going into the court of record process and start moving that process along and get you a court. Now, if they don't, do the same thing to that individual. So I'm sure then that they're going to be in jeopardy to do the right thing. But go ahead.
My question is, can I list both the federal and the state judges on this demand for this
Colorado? Absolutely, but you want to do it. You want to do it in its own court. If you're chasing the state, the officers of the court within a state, and you file a quo warranto on that, if you're already in the federal court at the same time, but the state court was the earlier part of that thing, so you're going through that process with the state court, which you're going to move into the federal court for execution. Now you do the same thing. Federal court, you do the federal court separately from the state court, okay, because that federal court has to go to the appellate, so it's their boss. You're taking it up to their boss.
Though the case is already in federal court, I still got to do the state judges separately?
I would do it so you don't get any confusion separately, so you got two cases going for bonds. And then you continue your case along because you're going after other individuals.
Now, can I put the clerk of courts on here?
The clerk of courts. If it's necessary, I don't know if it's necessary.
Specifically, yes, for refuse, you know, going along with the judge and concealment.
Well, again, if that's the case, then you can go after the clerk in that case also. You can mention the clerk as also a respondent. You see, if I was in a town court, which I've
done. Remember, I said one of them won't even give her last name. She thinks
you can go get her name. You can get her name, or you could put Jane Doe, clerk of court. Whatever information and a reason, and make the note, a reason why you're calling them, Jane Doe, is because they refuse to tell me who they are. They refuse to identify themselves. But, you know, look at any clerk that has been appointed, if they're in a court or if they're in a county clerk or whatever, just go to the government page and you'll see their name up there. They'll tell you the name of the clerk. One that was appointed, the one that any other clerk that works them, you'd be going after.
Yeah, her appears that there's a supervisor clerk who's under her, who their name does do not appear. You're not going to find it there.
You don't have to look it. You have to go after the one that was the one that took the oath. Okay. The ones that are underneath them didn't necessarily take an oath. They're employees. They're acting clerks, but they didn't take the oath, and they're working underneath the main clerk. The clerk that took the oath is responsible for all the clerks working underneath them. And if you have a problem, hold on. If you have a problem with the clerk, you want to make sure you're dealing with the clerk that has the oath. And if it's not the clerk that has the oath, you say, look, go get your boss, because, you know, we're going to be talking bonds here now. And we need to talk with that clerk and get that clerk involved. And then if they continue to refuse you your access or whatever it is they're refusing you, then that's the person you go after.
And what about the attorney general that's stepped in and interfered when no one was talking to her?
If the attorney general has violated you in any way in that court, has worked with them to deny you process or whatever the case may be, yes, they are the officer of the court. You can add that too. You can add two or three or more attorneys, prosecutor, then the attorney general, and anybody else that is an officer of the court.
Yeah, but one of their assistants came in and no one was talking to them. and they came and interfered when they passed the book, when I was trying to get that person's name.
Well, again, you have to make that point on paper concerning the violations. Now, you see, the violations that I spoke of in my paperwork here that I'm giving as an example, people have to use their head a little bit because they have to realize that the violations that are different. Okay, let me see where I got the violation. This is a notice and demand. Surety bond. What did I do? Did I close that?
All right. You can tell me what the violation is. Okay, I asked the head clerk, Elizabeth Warren, for the name of the supervisory clerk. She, in turn, instead of answering me, she passed it to the attorney general, and no one is talking to, I'm not talking to them. So they turned they took that book and answered me. Well, we can't give you that supervisor's name without our permission. That's how they did. That's concealment.
Well, you're not looking. Look at supervisor is one thing. You want the clerk that was elected. If you go to the page, or go to the website of that court or that county or whatever that clerk is at. Huh?
Do you understand the violation?
I'm not
right
sure.
There's a violation.
I don't know specifics, but go ahead.
Okay. By telling me. Okay, if I ask the head clerk, Elizabeth Warren, for the name of the supervisor who was actually handling my documents, who was under her, who hung up on me 3 times, whose name I asked for and refused to give it to me, and then the Elizabeth Warren, the head clerk, passed it to the attorney general.
The wrong person. Forget the supervisor. You want the clerk that was elected to that position or appointed.
Okay.
That's the person you will find that person on the website of whatever the agency, that agency's website, and they will give you, in the case of a court, they'll give you all of the list of the judge's names. They'll give you the name of the clerk of the clerk, which is again either an elected or appointed position, usually elected. County clerk. Hold on. The county clerk is elected. We know that. A court clerk in the court itself, that would be appointed. You need to find the appointed clerk. That name will be on that paperwork on that website. You'll get, and that's the person you address problems to, because that's the person who has the bond, and that's the person who's going to pull the bond.
Okay.
Now, remember, we read in this paperwork. Hold on. We read in this paperwork. There was a lot of wording. It's kind of wordy on a lot of these things, but we read in the paperwork, okay, that many of these states bond all their employees. So in theory, okay, not in fact, in theory, everyone is bonded that's working in that office, in theory. You don't know whether that's true or not, but that's what it seems to say. But again, I would not go after the ignorant. I'd go after, and remember, if they didn't take an oath, okay, if there's no oath, then that's a whole different story, I think. So I don't think that we should interpret it that way. I would always go after the oath taker. That's the person you want. Anybody who takes an oath, you find those oath takers, that's the person you're going to go after and demand.
All right, one more question. Okay, one more question. Now, the other defendants, okay, like the CPIS workers and all that on the state level, what about them who are evading and doing whatever they wish? Without a bond.
Who are these people again? What people?
The CPIS, Child Protective Services.
Oh, the child. Well, that's where you're going to deal with those people in the courtroom. Now, if there is if they're bonded, and I don't know whether those agencies require bonds because they don't take oaths. If they're not taking an oath, they're probably not bonded. I wouldn't worry about that. They're bonded in a different way, I think, because remember we read there were 3 or 4 different kinds of bonds, and one is a collective bond for employees, so however that works.
That takes care of,
that's an insurance policy that the state or the county or whatever agency is involved here, in this case it would be a county agency, that agency would take out, or that county would take out a bond for the employees. So when you go to court and you sue, those bonds will probably cover it. But I don't know. I guess you could chase them too, but I'd have to look into that. But those are the people you're suing. See, I'm suing a couple of federal agents, and I'm suing the for the IRS, and
yeah.
So those are the individuals I'm suing. I'm going after them personally. Now, they're going to probably be covered by some insurance policy. The state's going to pick up on that in the insurance
policy. Remember, Paul, there's that defendant in the case, which is now in federal court. So I'm asking, can I add all the defendants, including, remember, the sheriff is one? Because, remember, they are together with CPIS and ChildNet.
Look at the sheriff you're going to have to do on a separate way again. You know, unless the sheriff is actually in the court, he's not. Okay, there's a problem with the sheriff. You can deal with him directly with a notice and demand and pursue the same process. So you'll have three different cases going on with bonds.
Okay, so do the notice and demand on the sheriff and CPIS and ChildNet, who they're defendants in the case already.
You're suing them, so I don't know why you'd want to go that process at this point. Remember, I don't know how that would work on an employee thing. I think that covers a lawsuit, okay, when they fail to do something with somebody and they get sued. They're going to cover the monies that you're suing these individuals for.
Yeah, I'm already suing them, and that's one of the cases that the judge is holding up. Remember I told you they got a blank docket up right there, document up there on the docket, the seizure and sale and the cease and desist is blank, and they refuse to sign it.
Uh-huh. Well, again,
so those are depictions.
Suing them, okay, you're going to be, look at their employees making a certain amount of money. They're living check to check. They can't afford to give you anything. But if you're suing them in their official position, the county,
yes,
it's the county that they're working for, which CPS, APS, those are county levels. So the county has, and we read this in the paperwork, the county has a policy for employees. Okay, they're required by law to have a policy that covers the employees. Should they do something wrong and they get sued, then the policy covers those costs. Whatever you'd sue for. So, again, it depends on how, I don't know what a procedure would be to go after an employee. It's a whole different thing. They're not an oath taker, remember.
Yeah, I'm just asking concerning this bond that you're discussing, who I can and who I cannot put on this particular quo warranto, I mean.
Well, we've got three of them. You've got the state court, you've got the federal court, and then you got the sheriff direct. Anybody else, any of these agencies, their employees, you've got to sue them. Those are the people you're suing. That you've got to go into a court of record and sue them.
Yeah, that's what we are. Remember, I've done your procedure.
In order to get that court of record actually going and really have a court of record and get an untainted jury and to make sure it's untained, I mean, that's another process. I've written two handbooks on that. And I would bring those handbooks and I'd put it into the record because this is how these jurors have to be dealt with, and then you can bring it up and you can clean up the jurors' minds and problems right there in the courtroom, because if they don't debate and argue it out of that, and they can't argue it out, I mean, they're going to try.
Yeah, they're not going to give me a jury trial. They're just going to keep it there how it is. That's why I'm meeting this quo warranto, because
that's the purpose of pursuing their bonds, to get your court of record. Denying and hiding jurisdictions.
Exactly. Because at the end of the
at the end result, you're going to get a court of record. Why are you going to get a court of record? Because after you go after their bonds, they've already violated you. They now have to recuse themselves. That means another judge has to come in. That other judge is going to know exactly what took place in that court, what they've done, how they violated, and what you've done about it. And they're going to say, I'm not going to let this person violate me. And they're going to give you your court of record. And if not,
exactly.
You pull their bonds, do the same thing. You got four cases going for bonds.
Exactly, because I've already done. Remember, I've done all your procedure
this is the enforcement. This is the enforcement.
Yeah. Now here's next thing. All right.
Only a couple of minutes because we're coming to the end of our
program. Yeah,
we have another.
Yeah, but this is important. This is important. Now this is going to surprise you. All right, but I'm not going to go into detail on the public phone, okay? but we need to talk privately as soon as you get a chance. I heard a question about Mark Emery. Okay?
I think I wrote that. Let me see if I wrote that name down. Hold on.
Jan read your question that someone sent in.
Yes.
About
Mark,
should
Russ brought up the name of Mark from Lighthouse Liberty.
Yes. Well, guess what? You and I have a need to talk, have a talk about, believe it or not, because I do know him. Mm-hmm. All right, and I don't want I don't want to talk about people on a public thing. But before
okay. we could do something,
you
we could do something.
Yeah, for you.
We'll make we'll make an appointment at next Monday's program. After next Monday's program, we'll make an appointment. We'll get together for a phone call.
Yeah, so you can make an intelligent decision, okay? Because there's some things you need to know that okay. I do know.
All right, got it.
Okay, for your own protection.
All
right. Is all I'm going to say about that. Okay?
Okay. Appreciate it.
Yeah. Oh, okay. All right.
I,
so,
You
made a note. Did you ever find out about my, you said you were going to make a note. Did you find my Lord have mercy, the joinder? Did you find out about it?
Well, yeah, no, we're going through that now. It's moving a lot quicker than I thought, so I think, you know, in the next week or so we'll know, and then we'll be able to look through your name and get the joinder. If it's not there, we'll let you know. But if you gave it to us, we should have it, you know.
Yeah, I just said, it may have been, you know what I'm saying, because the problems that
we'll find out. You can always add in. I mean, but, you know, remember, if you add it in, we're definitely going to use your case as evidence, number one. If you're already pursuing the bonding, we won't pursue
it. I'm trying to say without saying it. I don't know what was done with it. Okay? You know what I'm saying?
I'll let you know. I can tell you that we haven't. All we've done is the paperwork. Whatever filing we've done, you'd be aware of those filings. We have not pursued it beyond that point because we were not in a position to pursue it beyond that point. We are now in a position to move past that point. This is one of the problems. Let me get this point out, though. This is one of the problems that we've had with people, that people aren't paying close enough attention. And what happens is, and I'm not talking about you or anything, but there are people, a lot of people in this category that I'm going to talk about. They're not coming to the meetings. They're not responding. And they're not doing what they have to do. We cannot pursue their case if they're not doing what they have to do. Okay? That's a major problem. But that's okay. We're still using their case as a joinder in the sense that we're going to use that as evidence. And it also places it as an opportunity to be heard for a denial of due process inside that federal court at the same time so that they could get some restitution there. But they have to be present for it. If they're not present, they're not going to get it. You see, that's the key here.
Yeah, but as I said, I have another concern that I don't really want to say. And I think you know what I'm trying to say, you know, without saying it.
Let's do this because I have to end on time because I got to pick my son up from work and I have another caller in here. But let's do this.
Okay.
Next week, I'm going to hopefully have the conclusion of this bond thing, as I mentioned, next week, and then we'll have opportunity to make an appointment for during the week to get a phone call, and we'll talk privately.
Yeah, we need to about this guy.
All right, let me go to Ross right now, then. Hopefully Ross is here, though. Okay?
Yeah.
All right,
okay,
thanks for the call.
All right.
Okay.
Okay,
Ross, you got the mic. Go right ahead. Your mic is open, Ross. We got 5 minutes left, so. Let me try this. Okay, Ross. Wait, I can't unmute him. Hey, Terry, can you unmute Ross? I can't get to his mic. I don't know why.
We'll try.
Let me try hitting the question mark, see what happens. Yeah, I can't get to his mic. It kind of just flickers away. Does it do that for you? All right, what I'm going to do, let me open, let's...
You hear me?
Okay, unmute yourself, Ross, and we'll try that.
You hear me?
I can hear you now. Go right ahead, Ross. We got a few minutes.
You remember I sent you the non-birth certificate, do-yourself no birth certificate? You have read that material?
What certificate?
The birth certificate.
I'm missing that. Spell it. What certificate?
B-I-R-T-H.
Oh, the birth certificate. Okay, what about it? What about it?
I send you a file from...
look at the birth...
International's website.
Yeah, the birth certificate is a subject that, you know, look at, I know up to a certain point there was no such thing as really the birth certificates. And remember, we're a Christian nation and births were recorded in Bibles, generally speaking. But, you know, the necessity of a birth certificate, that seems to make sense on the one hand, the way they're using it and the problems that that are caused by it, that's another thing. That's something that I think we need to speak about and have debates to try to come to a conclusion and to discover... What I don't have a position on that is my point. I tend to lean towards the fact that we should have birth certificates. I tend to lean there. But I have not heard the arguments or the debates on both sides to make a good decision. You know, I have to hear the arguments.
I heard that it's a bond on you for...
Right. They have used it in order to deal with us as chattel, livestock. That's what they've used it
for.
And that's what they produced it and pushed it for that purpose. You know, certificate of ownership almost, so to speak, I guess. You know, and they probably started this out on the slaves and then eventually moved it on to all the people. So it came from a negative and a evil perspective and position. So there's a case to be made for that. The need of a birth certificate sounds like we probably need it, but maybe not necessarily so. I don't know enough. I just have not heard the arguments to make a good decision on it one way or another. I'll try to get into that at some point. I got a lot of other things I need to be looking at and dealing with and researching and working with, but it's something that I don't have time to research at the moment.
You guys can help me with the exploratory statement for a passport application.
All right, so you're trying to get a passport?
Yes.
And you're having a problem with the birth? You're having a problem with the birth certificate?
No, it's not a problem with the birth certificate. It's just on the application, you only have a choice of U.S. citizen instead of a state citizen or a citizen of the United States.
Well, look, everyone's a citizen of the United States, and you become a citizen of the state you choose to live in, which you can change by just crossing the state line and saying, I'm here, now you're there. You don't, there's no paperwork, there's nothing required. You are what you are, and you are where you are. As far as a requirement of in order to get a passport, they need to get your birth certificate. You're not going to be able to defeat that. Again, the necessity of a birth certificate needs to be, you know, I need to hear the cases on both sides to feel that I can make a decision and a position, you know. So I don't have any worry on that.
So I don't see... If I want to apply for it, I don't want to mark the state's U.S. citizen thing because you don't know what that definition means.
Mm-hmm.
You're subject to the federal jurisdiction instead of
If you sent me something, I'm not sure I remember getting anything on it, but send it again to mail@nationallibertyalliance.org, and maybe by next Monday I'll be able to read through what you send me and maybe give some information or some thoughts, okay? But with that, I got to close down because I got to leave, right?
Okay.
All right.
Okay.
But
all right.
Thanks for the call. Okay, we're going to close down. Thanks, everybody, for coming, and hopefully we'll see you next Monday. And we'll get this particular one up on our, not YouTube, but we Rumble. But we also will have this up on our webpage anyway in MP3, but we'll try to get video up there. All right, with that, Lord willing, we'll see you next Monday. Thank you, everyone. Good night.